The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning. I'm Dan Metcalf of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, or CGS for short. And on behalf of CGS and the Washington College of Law here at American University, I want to welcome you to our second annual Freedom of Information Day program. CGS is something that started just about a year and a half ago here at the law school as an academic center for focus on matters of secrecy, transparency, openness in government, freedom of information, all those different formulations of the same basic thing. And we're pleased that we've been so successful thus far with the support of other members of the openness in government community, members of the academic community, especially here at the Washington College of Law, and also with the support of the Open Society Institute, which has been a major foundation support for what we have done thus far. This is Freedom of Information Day, and most, but perhaps not all of you know, that it's something that's been celebrated for many years now. About 20 years, I think, on the occasion of James Madison's birthday, James Madison being regarded not only as one of the founding fathers, but also the father of freedom of information. And about 20 years ago, the National Press Club started having events on that day. And then not too long thereafter, those events occurred at the Freedom Forum of the Freedom Forum's First Amendment Center, which now has just held its 11th Freedom of Information Day program, 3 days ago on Friday. And we're very pleased that this year the Collaboration on Government Secrecy is holding the program on Freedom of Information Day, James Madison's birthday, March 16th, also to kick off Sunshine Week. And we've been able to do that with close coordination and collaboration, I should say, with other members of the openness and government community, most specifically the Sunshine Week team and the Sunshine and Government Initiative. So we're very pleased and appreciative of that. This is the sixth program that we've held thus far, beginning in the fall of 2007 and including a program that we held on January 29th regarding information policy in the Obama administration. And of those six programs, we've now had a total of 60 different speakers, again, with the strong support of the Openness in Government program, and that's something that we've even now included on our website. You all have copies of the beta version, it's soon to be redesigned and upgraded, of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy website, and on the at the very beginning of it, we have a link to a subpage that has a list of all of CGS program speakers. So I commend that to your attention. You can see the people to whom we owe gratitude for supporting this type of program. We're going to have two more programs this year. One on April 28th will focus on an issue near and dear to the hearts of members of the media group contingent, I guess I could say, of the openness and government community. It's going to look at the Reporters Committee decision, the landmark Supreme Court decision that came down just 20 years ago in March of 1989, and the effect that that has had on public interest analysis, the balancing privacy interest under the Freedom of Information Act. And that's something that will be held right here in these nice facilities on April 28th, and I just want to draw that to your attention because you might be interested in that as well. And then, of course, on International Right to Know Day, which everyone knows is September 28th, of course, just as March 16th is Freedom of Information Day in this country, we will be having our third annual International Right to Know Day program right here, and we'll have some live hookups overseas. In the past, we've had live hookups with Paris and London and New Zealand, and I believe we will be doing likewise with Oslo, which during that same time will be hosting the sixth annual information conference or International Conference of Information Commissioners, and we'll be plugging into that as well as some other things. This is a special year. Make no mistake. This year is very, very special as we gather here together to celebrate Freedom of Information Day, because we are now coming out of, slowly but surely, 8 years of, I think, what everyone would generally agree has been the most secretive administration in modern American history. And there's a lot of room for improvement. There's a lot of high expectation for change. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the themes of our program today, that those expectations are very high. And one of the things that we'll be doing this afternoon is having an early assessment of the Obama administration to look to see how those high expectations are being met or not, just almost 2 months into that administration. We're also very pleased that our keynote speaker today is the longtime champion of freedom of information, both in general and in the Senate in particular, Senator Patrick Leahy. And he's going to be introduced by an alum of the Washington College of Law, former Congressman Tom Downey, who will present him with our 2009 Robert Vaughn FOIA Legend Award. We're also going to have a luncheon speech by Hal Relier. Many of you know Hal. He has worked in the Congressional Research Service since 1971 until his retirement just recently. And he is going to give us the benefit of his long years of experience. We also are very pleased to have here today the chairman and members of the Public Interest Declassification Board who are attending this program. They have particular interest, I know, in our first panel this morning regarding classification matters, but they're also going to be here at the Washington College of Law for their Sunshine Week meeting in our facilities here, and I hope you can join us at the reception that we have after the program at about 5 p.m., at which they'll be attending, and we'll be recognizing them as well. This afternoon, we're going to have panels on what we call pseudo-secrecy and another one on records management. I mentioned records management in particular because at that January 29th program, part of what we did was to take a survey of what you thought, the attendees and people who participated in our survey online, what you thought mattered most, was most urgent, most important as a matter of priority for the Obama administration to focus on in the openness and government area. And one of the top measures, one of the top five, was records management. And that's something that we told the Obama administration at the end of that program a week later, in early February. We sent letters with the results of that survey all throughout the Obama administration to a dozen different locations, to new high-level appointees. And I can assure you that that's already had some impact. We paid attention to the fact that records management was high on that list, high on the list of survey respondents, and that's in no small reason why we have that panel this afternoon. The other reason is that we have Scott Armstrong, a former investigative journalist, and we're celebrating, in effect, the 20th anniversary of the Armstrong versus the Executive Office of the President litigation, which started right at the beginning of the Bush 41 administration when there was focus on the records of someone, is anyone here old enough to remember Ollie North? And the Iran, yes, I know that gentleman over there is, and the Iran-Contra scandal. That's the subject of that. Then later on this morning in the second panel, which we'll roll immediately into after our first, we're going to focus on what I think is the hottest issue in the openness and government area. It's what we call bailout transparency. Transparency of matters pertaining to the TARP, everyone knows what that is, the economic stimulus activities that the government is undertaking, the money that goes to a little company called AIG and the like, not to mention other banks. And we're going to be having the co-organizers of something called the Coalition for Accountable Recovery speak to the strong need for greater transparency, simply so that we taxpayers can see where our money is going. And again, that'll be our second panel. But before we get to that, let me also mention one more thing, and that is we're particularly pleased that we have so many representatives of government agencies here. By last count, More than half of the cabinet agencies are represented, more than a dozen federal agencies all told. And we have people here who have come from New York, Ohio, Ottawa, someone registered from Tehran. I haven't met that person yet, but we do have that registration, and also someone from the Guangzhou province of China. So we're pleased that this program has having far-reaching effect, and it's consistent with the fact, or comports with the fact, that we are taking this responsibility very, very seriously to hold this program on FOIA Day. So with that by way of introduction, let me introduce also our panelists for our first panel. And what we're going to do throughout this program, to be as efficient as we possibly can, to get as much information and insight to you as possible, we're going to be relying on the fact that each of you has in your handout package a full detailed biographical sketch on each of our panelists. So we're going to save time, quite frankly, by just mentioning something briefly about each one. To my immediate right is someone who perhaps doesn't need an introduction to many of you, because it's Stephen Garfinkel, who was head of the Information Security Oversight Office, first within GSA, then briefly within OMB, although Steve might have blocked that time out of his mind, yes, and then at the National Archives and Records Administration. Among many other hats that Steve wore, he was the head of ISU for more than 20 years. And then next to him, to his right, geographically, not necessarily ideologically, is the current director of the Information Security Oversight Office, Jay Busenko. And Jay is in a very interesting position this year, to say the least. And then to his right is someone who should be known to many of you, especially those who follow his excellent, it's now a weblog, not just a newsletter that he publishes electronically, Secrecy News. That's Steve Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists, who I think I can fairly say is the premier observer, analyst, critic. I recently wrote an article in which I called Steve a secrecy puncturer in footnote 4 in this area. Simply put, if there is something to be known from that perspective regarding national security classification matters, and Steve doesn't know it, it probably isn't worth knowing. So with that brief introduction, what I'll do is sit down and start moderating ever so lightly this first panel, and I'll do so by throwing out a first question to Jay Busenko. And it's a softball, Jay. This is likely to be a very busy year for you, isn't it, with respect to overclassification, declassification, and executive order revision?
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate the opportunity to be on this panel today in such good company, and to appreciative of each of you giving your time to hear us speak. Yes, it looks like a busy year. A year ago when I took this position, I didn't realize how much would go by in that first year. We took on a new mission with respect to controlled unclassified information. You'll hear more about that from my deputy later today. We launched a big effort in the last year to go out and assess each and every agency's declassification program and score those. It'll be an ongoing program. And I look around today, and the staff is, if you count some detailees and contractor support we have, we're over 30 strong. And I was just sitting here realizing that when I arrived at ISU in December of 98, we were about a dozen. So despite the increase in staff and the increase in what we've been doing, the one thing I've realized is all that work just means more is getting done and more push to me. But I'm looking forward to it.
Steve, the other Steve here, how do things look from your vantage point? Having left ISU, I know, it's about 7 years ago? One thing I haven't mentioned is that Steve Garfinkel has a second career that is also public service oriented, in that he's a teacher of history and law and government at Einstein High School in Kensington, Maryland. So you're more plugged in with the younger generation, I would say, than just about anyone else, younger being younger than law students as well. What do you see coming up prospectively in this area?
If there is a new executive order, what I see coming up is a big mistake. And I don't mean doing an executive order is a big mistake. What I mean is I was fortunate enough, or I've been around long enough, to observe the development of every executive order since the Nixon executive order. And each one of them had in it something that went wrong. And my thought is that in the development of an Obama executive order, if that is to be, that will happen as well if history is any guide. What each mistake was very different in each one. At least, and of course, what I say is a mistake is strictly from my perspective, but one of the things that does concern me, of course, is that this administration, perhaps more than the others that were redesigning the executive order, may mirror the psychology of the Carter administration most, with the idea that they're coming in after the Bush administration, they have to change things radically. That was the psychology of the Carter administration when it replaced Gerry Ford and the Nixon order. And quite frankly, the big mistake of the Nixon order was that it was issued by Richard Nixon. It was actually an amazingly reformist executive order. It was the first to consider declassification very seriously. It did have a couple of other inherent major problems, but the Carter people came in with the idea of having to make radical change and introduce the idea of six-year declassification for everything. And that proved to be the undoing of that executive order.
So would you say, Steve, that the Obama administration should learn the lesson of the transition from Nixon Executive Order 11652 to Carter Executive Order 12065 and bear that in mind?
I would think very much so, because the executive order they're inheriting is really the Clinton executive order. There were changes made, a couple of poorly chosen changes made in amending the Clinton executive order, but it's not like they are truly coming in to amend a Bush system. It is largely the Clinton system that they are inheriting, and they would be wise to move slowly and to move wisely on it and not. And the last thing that I would say is our system of classifying and declassifying information, while rightly criticized, is still a model throughout the world. I spent 20 years being visited by both diplomats and intelligence agents of just about every major country in the world, either fearful of our system because it was so open, or envious of our system because it was more open than their own. And so I would be very, very concerned that we not move radically to change things and create a problem that is going to result in taking us backwards ultimately rather than taking us forward.
Steve, I think when I heard you utter the word slowly, I could see a twitch in the corner of Steve Aftergood's forehead there. Just a slight, almost imperceptible reaction, but I think he might indeed have some reaction or contrary view to that. Am I wrong in reading you, Steve?
You're close. I don't think the issue is fast versus slow exactly. Let me tell you about a classification problem that I have, because I think it's interesting in itself, and it also illuminates something about the classification system that we have and what's wrong with it. A couple of years ago, in response to legislation, the Director of National Intelligence declassified the total amount of money spent on the National Intelligence Program in 2007. It was $43.5 billion. Last year, he disclosed the amount in 2008. It was $47.5 billion. I submitted a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, to the Office of the DNI saying, okay, we know 2007, we know 2008. What is the budget for the National Intelligence Program for 2006? And they came back and said, oh, no, that's classified. And disclosing that information would damage national security. Now, the new DNI, Admiral Blair, said at his confirmation hearing that as far as he knew, had been no damage resulting from disclosure of the 2007 and 2008 budget totals, and that he intended to continue disclosing those numbers going forward. And so we have a situation under the current classification system where current intelligence spending is publicly disclosed, but intelligence spending from 2 or 3 years ago is deemed to damage the national security and is said to be properly classified. That's kind of a Zen Koan of classification policy where, if you ponder it long enough, you either reach enlightenment or you lose your mind. Because it's obviously illogical on its face, and yet it is sanctioned and indeed authorized by our current classification system. Now, one of the virtues of a good problem is that it sheds light and helps you to understand and evaluate possible solutions. So clearly there is something wrong with the current executive order that it permits a situation like this to arise. There's also it also highlights a limitation in the Information Security Oversight Office, which does oversight of the classification system government-wide. As indispensable as it is, and I'm a fan of ISU under all of its leaders, except for the first one who I didn't know, it doesn't offer a solution to this kind of contradictory practice. The PIDEB, the Public Interest Declassification Board, several of whose illustrious members are seated here, also, despite their stellar qualifications, are not in a position to fix this. In fact, I'm not aware of a situation, and I don't think the PIDEB has the authority to say, you know, you can't do that. You through no fault of your own, you do not have the authority to overrule agency classification decisions. The new OGIS, the new Office of Government Information Services, the ombudsman function that has recently been appropriated with $1 million to mediate disputes regarding Freedom of Information Act requests. Again, they have no authority to tell the DNI what you're doing is stupid. It makes no sense. You must disclose that information. OGIS is not going to be the solution to my problem. The courts, I have filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit on historical budget information, and the courts have basically said we're going to follow the lead of the agency head. If the DCI or the DNI or the director of CIA says, in my judgment, this information must remain classified, we, the courts, are not going to, not only are we not going to overturn it, we're not going to probe into the thought process behind it. So the courts in Freedom of Information Act litigation are not a solution. ICECAP, the Interagency Security Classification Appeals Panel, almost was a solution. A similar case involving historical budget information was presented to ICECAP about a decade ago. And I understand secondhand that there were tumultuous discussions that would be, you know, fascinating to learn about if I were permitted to, that there might be records about those in the Clinton Library that might eventually become available. But the bottom line is ICECAP also couldn't rectify this contradiction, you know, where current budget information is disclosed, but obsolete past budget information is deemed classified. So what do you do in a situation like that? How can you fix a classification system that permits that kind of situation to arise? You know, some of the discussion, some of the proposals for a revision of the executive order, I think, do not really come to grips with the reality that this problem presents. What if we amended the executive order to bring back the language in the Clinton order and other, some of the other orders that said, when in doubt, do not classify? Well, that wouldn't fix my problem because the DNI is not in doubt. The DNI is sure that he's right and that this old information should remain classified. So that kind of fix, while it, you know, while it might give us a sort of burst of good feeling, doesn't come to grips with the real problem. So finally, what would come to grips with the real problem? There is at least one instance where an initiative has been successfully taken to go into the guts of the classification system and to rewrite, to reprogram its classification practices. And that is a 1995 Department of Energy initiative known as the Fundamental Classification Policy Review. It was a component of Secretary Hazel O'Leary's openness initiative. And what Secretary O'Leary did at the time is she told her agency, I want you to convene a bunch of working groups, and I want you to go through each of our agency's hundreds, there were 800 or more classification guides, review them and update them. Now, a classification guide is kind of a manual that specifies what information, what unit of information should be classified at what level. It basically is the software behind the classification system. Secretary O'Leary said, I want all of those guides reviewed. I want them updated. I want you to eliminate obsolete classification practices, and I want you to do it openly as far as possible. I want there to be public input. I want there to be an opportunity for public review. Obviously, some of the work needed to be done behind closed doors because it involved matters that were themselves classified. But after a year-long effort with several public meetings, the participation of 50 subject matter experts from DOE and the Department of Defense, hundreds of classification categories were eliminated. In other words, things that DOE had been saying needed to be classified, they decided, you know what, they don't need to be classified anymore, and we're erasing them from our classification guides. Now, they also found a dozen or so things that on closer examination they felt needed to be upgraded. They needed to be raised in classification level. It wasn't a sort of mindless, let's, you know, tear up everything and throw everything open. What it was an intelligent attempt to come to grips with real national security issues and to structure the classification policy to reflect that. And I think something along those lines is what needs to be done. with every major classifying agency, the Defense Department, the State Department, Justice Department, CIA, they need to be told, go back, review every one of your classification guides with an eye towards eliminating whatever can be eliminated. Reducing classification is not a favor to public interest groups. It is a favor to government itself. When you have too much classification, you waste money, you reduce operational efficiency. Every agency has a self-interest in reducing classification to the minimum possible. And if I could write one provision of a new executive order, it would be an instruction saying, I want each of the major classifying agencies to perform a review along these lines with the objective of minimizing classification. On a concluding note, I would just mention in Jay's latest ISU annual report, the most shocking and amazing statistic in the annual report of the Information Security Oversight Office was not the fact that government agencies classified 23 million or whatever new secrets last year. That, you know, that almost is, it doesn't mean what it appears to say. What was most shocking, rather, was that Jay found that agencies had not reviewed two-thirds of their classification guides in the last 5 years. In other words, they were operating their classification system on the basis of classification guides that had not been reviewed in years. That is a way of, in effect, perpetuating obsolete classification practices. And instead of automatic declassification, what we get is automatic overclassification. So again, just to conclude, I think that all the sort of rhetorical statements that we all are given to and, you know, that are necessary and understandable, they don't come to grips with the problem. At this stage, you know, 50 years into the classification program, we need to come to grips. We need to get our hands on the nuts and bolts of the classification system. We need to fix the process of deciding what is classified and what is not, so that we don't have an absurd situation where I can find out the 2007 intelligence budget on the ODNI website, but the 2006 intelligence budget is classified as a national security secret, because that makes no sense.
Thank you for that, Steve. And let me just say, gentlemen, as we go along this morning, in the spirit of Freedom of Information Day and of collaboration as well, I'm going to try to see where we might have common ground and areas of agreement as well. But before, or as we move toward that, let me just throw it out to both Jay and then the other Steve. What do you think of what Steve Aftergood has suggested with respect to that last point? Do you see that as realistic from where you stand?
Well, let me sort of address what both Steve said. What we have basically are two key issues that need to be dealt with. One, Steve's right. The executive orders, you know, they've all contained mistakes, and there are a number of them that were implemented in 1995 and in 2003. And I often tell new staff when they arrive in the office that executive orders in this area typically are evolutionary, not revolutionary. I mean, there may be revolutionary concepts that get embedded in them. You know, for example, the concept of automatic declassification in 1995.
Jay, excuse me. When you said Steve is right, did you mean Steve to your left is right, or Steve to your right is right, or both?
They're actually both right.
Okay, just checking.
I'm first talking to what Steve said, and then I'll talk to what the other Steve
that
said.
That would be Steve to your left geographically, if not ideologically.
Correct.
Okay.
So what this... you know, what this year provides us with is an opportunity to build upon the existing framework, to look at, you know, take the lessons learned since 1995 and since 2003, fix the mistakes, if you will, and improve upon it. I don't think we're looking at a situation where there's going to be a wholesale new executive order. I think what we're looking at is just that, building upon the existing framework and further improving it. Steve Aftergood spoke to an issue, and it comes down to whether or not there's a problem with the order or with its implementation. And he spoke a little bit about ISU and its capability and what have you. For the last couple of years, ISU's made the point that agencies need to actually adhere to the requirements of the executive order. That's part of the problem here. Steve made reference to the classification guide issue. The executive order and our directive require that class guides be reviewed whenever necessary and at least once every 5 years. We went out last year, we polled agencies, found out that 67% of the guides hadn't been updated within the time frame. And I'm not talking by days or months or even a year or two. There were hundreds of guides that hadn't been reviewed since the president made changes in 2003, and hundreds of guides that hadn't been updated since the issuance of the executive order in 1995. So if those are the foundation upon which agencies are making classification decisions, clearly it needs to be fixed. We're trying to fix it within the confines of the executive order. So we went out a year ago. We found this out over the last year. My staff's been reaching back out to those agencies. A lot of them still hadn't taken any action to update it, so we've done another data call, and we're prepared to issue letters to agencies that if those guides aren't updated, basically instructing them not to use them. And also we've asked for the identification of each of those OCAs by name, because we figure it's been over a year if action hasn't been taken. So we're trying to sort of take ISU's authority and take it a few steps further than we've done in the past. But we also need to look at not just addressing what can be further improved upon in the executive order, not just addressing its implementation, but there are some new aspects of how agencies work, how ISU works, that need to be accommodated within the order. We've made the point in the past that in the electronic environment, aspects of the order are still based in a sort of a paper-based environment. I'm actually, when I'm talking about changes to the environment, I'm not so concerned about those. Agencies are very adept at figuring out how to adjust the guidance for the electronic environment, and we're not ignoring that. We're taking some actions in that area. But the electronic environment makes it much more difficult and much more important that agencies get their decisions right in the first place. 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, when an agency made a decision in the declassification area, for example, that decision largely existed in a vacuum. The individual that received that FOIA request response, or the individual that was working in a box out at the National Archives, they discovered something, and they might publish it in a book or in a paper that where it got a little bit of attention, but more often than not, the decisions weren't far-reaching. In today's environment, somebody can be out at the National Archives or receive a FOIA response, and that day take a declassified image and place it online, and it's accessible by many. And what happens is, in the electronic environment, you can start to weave the web. You can start to look at decisions agencies have made on like information, and you can start to see the gaps. And this is a concern from a safeguarding perspective. Agencies need to be more consistent with the decisions they're making, but it's not just on the declassification end of it. On the front end, when agencies are making classification decisions, in the operating environment is not forgiving. It doesn't allow for agencies to be handling information differently within their agencies or across agencies. So we've got to find ways in the executive order to start bringing some rigor to the classification and declassification process.
Steve, you were the other Steve. You were director of ISU during the time that Hazel O'Leary initiated that program that Steve Aftergood spoke of. I know that it arose from the declassification process and the openness process she established with respect to what were called human radiation experimentation records at the very end of 1993 and the very beginning of 1994, and then it loomed larger or took on a larger life thereafter. How did you regard that from ISU's perspective then, which would shed light on whether that could be a viable model today.
I don't think it was a model for the system as a whole. It was an effort to make reforms in the Atomic Energy Act, and certainly those are reforms that still need to be done. That was the Atomic Energy Act secrecy is the one area where ISU had no jurisdiction over it, and certainly for the category formerly restricted data, that is a true anachronism and that still needs to be corrected. Formerly restricted data is a ridiculous category of information to be governed by the Bourne classified rule of the Atomic Energy Act and should be subject to the rules of protection and declassification under the executive order.
So
I don't agree with that as a model. I think what the DOE was doing at the time was a very good thing, but it was pretty much specific to DOE.
So if that's not a model, what about the other Steve says about the
guides?
The guides, exactly.
Yeah, I'd like
right.
to go back to the guides.
The guides.
What Steve needs to have put in the executive order is absolution to all authors of classification guides who stretch too far on the way of openness. Because what he is really fighting against is not the system as it's written, but he's fighting against human nature. It's the nature of human beings to be cautious. And a reason for so much of the overclassification is erring on the side of caution instead of erring on the side of protection. It's very easy to err on the side of protection. You're not going to get in any trouble. And unless and until he can come up with some way of either psychologically absolving these people of any sins or legally absolving them of any sins, I think the system is there right now to be done much better. With my colleagues, a couple of my former colleagues from the PIDB here, Marty and others, a couple of years ago, or was it a year ago, they came out with that big report, Marty, about a year ago. And of course, it was absolutely the wrong time to come out with a report on openness. But now that it's no longer the wrong time to look at it, I hope that report gets another look at. And first of all, I want to first say I was not the author of that report, and I was the worst member of the PIDB by far. The Marty and Britt Snyder deserve unbelievable credit for that report, and there are many, many really good things in it, and many of them deal with the practicalities of this problem rather than the theories. It's the practicalities that in many ways hold us back. Let me give you one example and then I'll stop. I was for the almost till its end the chairman of the little commission that was dealing with Nazi war crimes records. And that was after I had retired from ISU. And we truly, on that group, reached the cutting edge of declassification. We truly reached the cutting edge of declassification. We declassified huge portions of raw intelligence files of bad guys. And this had, going into those files had just never, ever been done before. This was a part of the agency you just never touched. And the quantity of files that were declassified and the range of information that was declassified was truly without precedent. And yet I doubt that anyone has seen any of that today, even though it was declassified 2-3 years ago. And the reason for that is the National Archives does not have the capability of opening the records that have been declassified. They don't have the physical resources to make available the millions upon millions upon millions of pages of material that have been declassified, including some rather remarkable stuff that that little group declassified. I think we ended up declassifying about 8 million pages of records, but not that it disclosed a new theory of World War II or anything like that, but it certainly established on the cutting edge how far you could go in opening the most sensitive of records in certain circumstances, and yet nobody's been able to look at them. And the PIDB report brought that out very clearly. That is right now a far more important problem, quite frankly, to access the information than changing the executive order.
Steve Aftergood, I know you don't need any assistance, believe me, in responding or making further points, but I'll just note that there was a reference to the new head of the National Intelligence Office of Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair, and to his confirmation hearing. And he did speak at that hearing about the need for a quote-unquote cultural change. Could that be part of what you're talking about as well? And could that also go to what these gentlemen are speaking about, especially what Steve Garfinkel just said about human nature?
It could, and hopefully it will. For me, it leaves me a little bit impatient because cultural change is too abstract and open-ended, and it can be interpreted in different ways by different people. Who's really against cultural change? Tell me who's against it, and I'll tell you whether I'm for it. Nobody's saying they're against cultural change. So I don't. For me, it's not really a helpful construct. I'd like to respond to two particular things that Steve Garfinkel said. Could the Department of Energy's Fundamental Classification Policy Review serve as a model for other agencies? Steve didn't think so because it was an Atomic Energy Act issue, and it was separate from the National Security Classification System. I would disagree. I think it illustrates that a reevaluation of classification standards can be carried out even in the most sensitive of government activities. There's nothing more sensitive that the government does than its handling of nuclear weapons. The Classification Policy Review dealt with the design, production, utilization of nuclear weapons. It's the most sensitive topics there are. Intelligence sources, covert action, that's not more sensitive than nuclear weapons design. And yet this was carried out in a at least partially public way in an effort to reduce classification, and it succeeded. Very few things succeed in these areas, and this one did succeed, and therefore I think it is a model not necessarily to duplicate but to learn from. And I think it's one of the best models we have. Other point, Steve said that a lot of the disagreement has to do with questions of caution, that classification officers are being cautious. Those who are demanding disclosure are, being less cautious. And I think that's true in many cases, and it's reflected in disagreements over various kinds of disclosure decisions. But I think there's a much deeper problem that Steve has not yet acknowledged, and that is that there is a corruption in the classification system. And what I mean by that is reflected in the example I gave. You can find out the 2007 intelligence budget on the DNI's website, but they tell you that the 2006 intelligence budget would damage national security. Now, Steve, is that being cautious or is that being foolish?
That's being stupid.
Okay, well, we agree.
There's a difference between stupidity and corruption. The word corruption, I totally disagree with.
I said corruption in the system. I didn't say that individuals were corrupt. When the system produces stupid results, it is a corrupt system. And I don't mean it's venal or somebody's being bribed.
Perhaps broken.
I think Steve.
Let's say broken.
Steve means it, I think, in the way that a disk could be corrupted in your computer. In a mechanical way, perhaps.
That's not what I meant, but I wish I had.
Yeah. You wish you had, absolutely. Let me throw this up. Jay, you, if I understood you correctly, and I think I was paying close attention, you spoke of a prospective executive order, and you spoke of it as if, in your estimation, it's more likely to be a revision of an executive order rather than a fresh one. And by that I mean to say, up until the Bush executive order in 2003, each succeeding administration had replaced the executive orders of their predecessor. They were fresh ones each time. Yet President Bush 43 was the first to basically take the Clinton one to work with it and just amend it. Do I understand you correctly that that is what you're predicting to be likely to happen this time around?
Yes, although I think if you were talking to a representative of the administration, they'd say that they weren't amending so much the Bush order, but dusting off the original intent of the Clinton order and then further revising it. But I think that's the idea. We've reached that point, I can say this much, where the administration is looking at the executive order and its related policies and trying to figure out, its road ahead. And, I think... some sort of action is imminent, and it will, I believe it'll be a revision, not a whole new effort.
Well, that does tend to confirm a lot of the rumors that have been swirling around in recent days that the Obama administration is mindful of the fact that this is Sunshine Week, mindful of the fact that this area is a matter of great concern to the openness and government community and elsewhere. It's a matter of importance as well, and there might be an issuance from the White House imminently that would speak to this process of either replacing or revising or dusting off the current executive order.
But I need to make the observation that while in large measure it may be a dusting off, the administration has committed to sort of address what Steve Garfinkel was speaking to earlier about capability at the archives. The administration committed during the campaign, during the transition, and it remains a promise that is on its website today, the creation of a National Declassification Center, a concept that was recommended by the Moynihan-Combest Commission in 1997 and again by the Public Interest Declassification Board in 2007. So that may be the revolutionary aspect of it, but other than that, I believe it'll be a revision.
So no one should be surprised if there's finally additional attention placed on the importance of a National Declassification Data Center, especially now that the declassification mandate finally came due, so to speak, as of December 31st, 2006, and agencies are in the process of declassifying records on an automatic 25-year basis. Although I can tell from your face, Jay, that perhaps that has not gone as quickly as some might have expected. Well, am I reading too much into that?
No, I think Steve alluded to it. There's 450 million pages and increasing at the National Archives at College Park that have been reviewed, touched by agencies, but which require additional declassification processing, not to mention the archival processing that's necessary before the public can have access to those materials. So one of the things the National Declassification Center would do would be to basically, to oversimplify it, to move us towards a pick up a box once, finish it, and then move it to the public, whereas right now a box is touched. We've seen examples of an individual agency reviewing the same box. This is the same agency, five times since 1995. The box still hasn't gone to the public, and there are still numerous other agencies' equities that are in that box that are going to require attention. So we've got to move to a much more streamlined, efficient, and effective declassification process. A National Declassification Center can do that. Additionally, what I spoke to earlier about consistency in decision-making is something that's absolutely critical today, and which a center can help facilitate. Instead of having agencies make decisions in a vacuum, they'd be making them in the context of the records, with awareness of past decisions, and with mechanisms to deconflict. And you've got categories of information out there that different agencies treat in different ways, even though it's the same information. Some may have gone to ICECAP and gotten permission to keep it classified for until it's 35 years old, and another agency may have sought the authority to keep the same information classified for 50. It doesn't make any sense.
So it sounds as if, to try to synthesize before we go to questions from the audience, we have multiple levels here of things that contribute to the ultimate outcome, or not in the case of records that never do see the light of day. The first is the standard in the executive order as it exists or as it might be revised or dusted off. The second would be the implementing standards of the guides, the declassification guides or classification guides that agencies use. And then there's Steve's point of distinguishing that from implementation in and of itself. And then beyond that, there's both implementation with respect to the actual act of declassification to begin with. Then the final step, which is taking something that's declassified, that has been paid attention to by agencies, and then actually getting it out so it's accessible to the public. And that's where the NARA end of it is so important, isn't it?
Yes. You know, we spend the declassified number that we use in our annual report to the president is about $44 million a year. That doesn't include the intel community numbers. We'll just say that we're looking at roughly $80 million a year being spent on declassification. And, you know, it's been said by my predecessor, Bill Leonard, that, you know, we don't really need to spend more money on declassification. We just need to spend it more wisely. And one of the things that needs to change is to focus that limited or that finite amount of resources that we have for declassification on the records that are that the public can have ready access to. The current system requires agencies to go out and process referrals for equities of other agencies in records that are still in the Washington National Records Center or in other federal record centers. These are records that haven't yet been transferred to the National Archives, and in some cases the transfer won't occur for another 10 or 15 years. So why would we want to be out there reviewing records when there's records at the National Archives in both the legal and physical custody of the archives that the public could have access to if only they were processed?
Before we go to questions, any concluding thoughts that either of the Steves might have?
On the question of revision of the executive order, evolutionary, revolutionary, those are just adjectives. The question for me will be, does the revised executive order reduce the likelihood that the classification system will produce absurd results? Right now it is producing absurd, or as my teacher Steve Garfinkel said, stupid results, as exemplified by the intelligence budget disclosures and non-disclosures. The question is that going to be fixed? Or not, and if it's not, then the revision is not going to be. It's going to be a missed opportunity.
Yes, Jerry.
If I could just respond to that, Steve. You know, one of the things I was thinking about for this panel was looking at the title, and it starts off overclassification, declassification, and the likelihood of change. And overclassification is something that's gotten a lot of attention in the recent past. We've had bills introduced into the House on overclassification, hearings on overclassification. I've only been the director of ICU for a year, but the one thing I figured out is overclassification is never going to go away. There will always be examples that people will be able to point to show that there are flaws in the system. Now, last year, there were 23 million classification decisions. Were some of them, maybe even a lot of them, stupid? Perhaps. But there's also a lot of hardworking individuals in the classification program, well-meaning, well-intended individuals. Do we need to do more to make the program better? Absolutely. But over classification, it's been a challenge for decades, and it's going to continue to be a challenge.
Speaking of challenges, is anyone interested in presenting a challenge to our panelists in the form of a question? The microphones are at the aisles there, and I believe they're live. So if you want to just go to one side or the other, go ahead, please, sir.
Thank you. Good morning. First, just want to thank you all for attending this panel. It's really been very informative. I'm Ethan Marin. I'm a 3L here. And regarding overclassification, one thing I'd be interested in any future revisions of the current executive order. The current order allows for the classification of information of documents purely because they pertain to the foreign relations of the United States. And I have a great deal of sympathy for that. It's very difficult to conduct diplomacy in broad daylight. That being said, the current executive order does seem to be producing, if not absurd results, at least highly counterintuitive ones. For example, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, a draft agreement currently being negotiated between the United States, the EU, Japan, and others. There was a group that recently filed a FOIA request for this, a group called Knowledge Ecology. And this request was denied because the draft documents involved were classified. Now, this is a purely economic agreement, which doesn't really touch on our national security apparatus in the conventional sense of the word. And so I guess my question for the panel would be twofold. First, do you think decisions like that, classification of draft negotiation documents of purely economic agreements, do you think that classification of those is appropriate? And if not, do you believe that there are any changes to the executive order that could, should, or will be made to keep that from happening in the future? And I know that's a mouthful, but thank you very much.
I'll take the first shot. Sort of as far as that specific treaty, I, of course, haven't seen it. But, I think a couple of points. One, today, arguably more than perhaps in the past, our economic well-being is tied to our national security. So I think one of the principal reasons we have a classification system is to support diplomacy and to allow open and frank discussions between parties that are negotiating a treaty. And sometimes that means either because of concerns on the other end, the other party, or our internal concerns. We need to classify some of those materials to protect negotiating positions and things like that. So can it be classified? Absolutely. Are treaties that are being negotiated often classified? Absolutely. But I think you make a good point. The front end, as I often refer to it, the initial standards that are there for classification are very broad. Extremely broad. And my office has traditionally given great deference to the agencies when it comes to the decisions they make. We tend to push harder and challenge them at the end of the life cycle when you're looking at declassification after 25 years. But I would argue that those front-end standards need to be tightened up, and I hope it's something that will be examined if and when we look at the executive order.
I also haven't seen the documents, although I think it's significant that they have been leaked and published online, and that also, I think, ought to figure into the decision of whether they should be withheld. My own inclination is to doubt it and that they should be released. The larger policy point, I would say, is there need to be more sort of decision points in the process where you can go and say, wait a minute, does this really make sense? Either, you know, perhaps the there's been discussion in the past about employing the agency inspectors general to augment ISOO's classification oversight activity, you know, so that one could go to the inspector general and say, wait a minute, does this really comply with not only the executive order but also good policy? I think I would also like to see Congress getting more active in classification oversight and exercising their own independent judgment on, you know, is this a case where the integrity of diplomacy really depends on classification, or is this a case where there has been overreaching by the executive branch? We need more sort of venues or forums where those questions can be asked. Right now, you know, there aren't enough.
Question on this side of the room here.
Michael Binder, Air Force Declassification Office, previously with Department of Energy. Two observations. One, I've dealt with FOIA. The Air Force is a two-time winner of the Rosemary Award for worst FOIA performance, and our office is trying to alleviate some of the sins committed by other Air Force organizations. So I've done some FOIA reviews, and I've noticed that agencies just don't know how to review. I have Air Force people who are reviewing restricted data when they're not supposed to. I have the State Department taking formerly restricted data exclusions when they're not supposed to. I've got Air Force people taking STRATCOM exemptions when they're not supposed to. And one of the major problems is that our FOIA reviewers just aren't trained. And there really is nothing institutionalized to train people to give them that experience. And the second observation has to do with formerly restricted data. A lot of information was declassified in 2004. Now, it was ready to be declassified in 2002, but for 2 years, Energy tried to get together with the Defense Department and couldn't get any cooperation. And they're still trying to get together with Defense, and it really comes down to maybe one or two individuals who dragged their feet. And so I would say to you that if you want to get something accomplished, that you should somehow, through OSD, get those people off the dime, get them to meet with DOE, and we can get a lot more information declassified.
That's OSD being the Office of the Secretary of Defense, DOE being the Department of Energy, not the Department of Education. Have to be careful here when we throw around the letters of the alphabet soup that everyone understands what we're talking about. Sorry, Jay.
Michael, good points. And I have to echo the one you made about increasing training for FOIA officers. One of my responsibilities as the director of ISOO is to serve as the executive secretary of the ICECAP, the Interagency Security Classification Appeals Panel. And that body serves as the highest appellate authority for mandatory declassification review requests, which I'm going to oversimplify things, but basically think it's a parallel to FOIA, but it only allows you to seek the declassification of classified materials. Steve Aftergood made the point that the courts often defer, if not often, almost always defer to the expertise of the executive branch agency. The ICECAP doesn't do that. And since 1996, the ICECAP has declassified information in 65% of the materials that has come before it. And you don't see that in the FOIA world. And when you look at the mandatory declassification review program statistics, you see that some, you know, it's greater than 80%, I can't remember the exact statistic, of MDR requests result in the declassification of information. That isn't the case with FOIA. So I often ask myself, how is it possible that we have such a disconnect? And very often I'm seeing information that's being denied under FOIA, using the FOIA B1 for national security information, that absolutely shouldn't be. And so there's I think there's a tendency, this is my personal opinion, that in the FOIA world, the reviewers look at the document and say, is it classifiable? And if it is, they apply the B1. And there's a lack of sort of towing that line and saying, should it be classified? Mm-hmm. And there's also a disconnect where if you're dealing with older records where the FOIA officers don't often are housed in different parts of the agency and don't have a lot of connectivity, if you will, with their the automatic declassification review folks, who are very much aware of what's been released that's more than 25 years old.
Thank you for that candor, Jay. It points up the importance of a good collaborative relationship between your office and my former office, the Office of Information Policy at the Department of Justice, not to mention with the new Office of Government Information Services being created at NARA. Let me conclude by just mentioning one, or throwing out one quick question that was phoned in by someone who couldn't be here, who's out of the country. But that person pointed to the fact that in the past there's been some controversy over what's sometimes called public interest balancing under the executive order. And that person pointed out to me that there is indeed a public interest balancing provision in the current executive order at, quote unquote, the back end only with respect to declassification. So I'd like to just briefly, very, very quickly, because we want to roll into our second panel in less than a minute, ask you whether you foresee any possibility that the new revised executive order will include public interest balancing at the front end at the time of classification to begin with.
One of the things I started doing when I first started at ISU back in 98 was to never go anywhere without my handy-dandy EO, because actually there's a slight difference there. The balancing test is not at the back end. This is probably one of the biggest misperceptions about the EO and frequently comes up when people look at what happened in 2003 as far as changes in the EO. The balancing test exists regardless of the age of the information. In section 3.1A, B.
3.1B, yes.
Let me start with A, because A points out that information shall be declassified as soon as it no longer warrants continued classification. That applies throughout the life cycle, okay? And then the requirement that is at 3.1B, once a decision has been made, if there is a overwhelming public interest in its declassification, and an agency head can make that decision, and they can make that at any time. There isn't a piece up front anymore which says, when in doubt, don't classify, but or a public interest piece that sort of ties the doubt, you know, at the time of original classification.
Right up front at the basic classification authority level as opposed to the head of the agency.
Right. But I think those are largely symbolic. I mean, the concept of when in doubt, it's an important concept. But as Steve Eftergood pointed out, the people that are applying the classification decisions aren't in doubt. And as Steve Garfinkel pointed out, there's a tendency for people to want to sort of make the safe decision. That's why we have very little confidential classification activity, a little bit more, but still very little top secret. Everything ends up, you know, it's the Goldilocks principle. Everything ends up in the middle because secret's kind of, you know, it's safe. It's not too little or not too much.
I see. Well, with that, I want to thank you very much for this presentation this morning to start us off on FOIA Day. Please join me in thanking this panel.